This is Dave Lapham, and you're listening to the Home of the Bengals, ESPN 1530.
You sure are. How you doing? Good afternoon. I'm Mo Egger. It's Friday. This is ESPN 1530. How are you? Hope you're having a marvelous... Use the word marvelous a lot, I noticed at the top of the show. Glorious, great, nice, splendid, pleasant, awesome, delightful Friday afternoon. Ideally, your weekend is off to a great start. Let's hope so. Our weekend starts early today. We're done at 5:30. NKU basketball in Norse and Wright State. This has become a good rivalry. Remember, Wright State won the league title, clinched the regular season championship on NKU's home floor last year. That Wright State team is really good. Top 60 in the net rankings. So a tough task for a Norse team that has been playing really, really well. Won 7 of 8. That game tips off at 7 p.m. Pregame coverage starts at 5:30, bumping us out of the way right here on ESPN 1530. Papa John's weekend tip-off in the 5 o'clock hour as we look ahead to the weekend in college basketball, which we'll get to coming up as well in just about 30 minutes because a critical stretch is starting for one head coach, and I'm guessing you can guess who it is. Plus, we have to get to college basketball's biggest question, and I think there is a largely useless exercise that is even more useless now when it comes to the NFL and the Bengals. We'll do that in the 4 o'clock hour. You'll hear from David Bell a little bit later on. You'll hear from Tucker Barnhart and Tyler Stevenson in the 4 o'clock hour. I want to start with the Reds because I was having a conversation with Tony Pike today about something that I've brought up on this show. Tony and I do Cincy 360 an hour, at least an hour on Fridays. We do the noon to 1 hour together. And we got to a question that I think I asked it last week, maybe earlier this week, which is simply this. The expectations and the hope for the Reds a year ago at this time was sky high. Nothing but optimism. Nothing but people thinking this team was going to be really, really good, or at least pretty good. Now, not so much. And I think, in large part, not that much has changed. A lot has changed, but in the grand scheme of things, this team this year doesn't look that dissimilar from the team the Reds had at the beginning of the season last year. And last year at this time, everybody thought this team's going to be really good. Now, I can't find anybody who thinks this team's going to be even halfway decent. I didn't think the Reds were going to be really good last year, but I don't think they're going to be really bad this season. I kind of feel the same way I did about last year's team. I thought they were about an 84, 85 win team. I think this year's team is about an 81 or 82 win team. And while that's not going to be good enough to get them to the postseason, it's going to be good enough to have them in a position to contend and maybe get a guy at the trade deadline, or if one or two things goes right, because this division, I think, is going to be won by a team that wins fewer than 90 games. Perhaps, maybe, the Reds could sneak in. But the term margin for error was brought up. Tony was talking about defense, team defense, the part of baseball we talk about the least. I always look at teams through their margin for error, right? Like, what's your margin for error? The Reds this season have, I think we would agree, a pretty slim margin for error, right? They're in a division that is going to be decided, I'm guessing, by a handful of games, 1 through 4. Last year, 5 games in a 60-game season, 5 games separated teams, 1 through 4. All 4 made the playoffs. There is nothing about this team that I think is going to be great. There's also nothing about this team that I think is going to be abjectly terrible. I genuinely believe that they will hit better this year, in large part because I don't think they can hit worse. And I do believe that last year, in many respects, not entirely, luck was not on their side. That tends to swing back in the other direction year to year. I think they'll be a little bit of a luckier team this season. And I think the woes of last year, you know, you do have to remember it was 2 months. It's confined to 2 months. We're getting ready for, we hope, a 6-month season. I think this team will be somewhere in the middle of the pack offensively. I don't know what metric you want to use, but somewhere in the middle of the pack offensively. ESPN ranked everyday starting lineups, likely everyday eights for all 30 major league teams. And they had the Reds listed as 18th. Identifying that there's some depth to that lineup, there's not a lot of high end. Like there's nobody that you look at and go, that guy's the best at his position, or that guy's a top 5 guy at his position, or that guy's likely to be the National League starter in the All-Star game at his position. It's also not an awful lineup. There is a glaring hole at shortstop, but it's really their only glaring sort of just, it's an enormous hole, but it's really their only one. And I think everybody in that lineup, if I said to you, Mike Moustakas is going to have a good year, that's plausible. If Joey Votto is going to have a good year, not a 2016 type year, but he's going to have a good year, that's plausible. If I said to you, Jesse Winker is going to have a good year, that's plausible, right? So this lineup to me is kind of middle of the pack. This starting staff, I think, has a chance to be good. I don't know if I'd go with great. Luis Castillo was awesome his final nine starts last year. Sonny Gray is Sonny Gray. Tyler Mahle had a good season last year. A very good season if you kind of look at what was needed from him, especially given the fact that he was on the outside looking into the rotation last year. At the same time, you know, back ends of the rotation are often unreliable. And while I like Michael Lorenzen, I don't know what he's like starting 30 games. While I really like TJ Antone, if he's the guy, I don't know what that looks like starting 30 games. Wade Miley's a huge wild card, wasn't very good, wasn't very healthy last year. I think the starting staff has a chance to be the team's biggest strength. I don't know if it's going to be awesome. Probably somewhere on the higher end of the middle of the pack. I think this team's bullpen still, as much as I wish they wouldn't have gotten rid of Raisel Iglesias, as much as I wish they wouldn't have gotten rid of Archie Bradley or at least got something in exchange for him, still some guys in that bullpen that are pretty damn good. Let's hope Lucas Sims is healthy. He says he'll be ready to go by opening day. Lucas Sims had a really nice year last year. And Amir Garrett's awesome. And whoever's not in the starting rotation between Lorenzen and Antone, that's a pretty good arm for your bullpen. And Sean Doolittle has a track record of success. And then you kind of sort through the other guys. Their bullpen is probably not going to be awful. It's probably going to be middle of the pack, which means the margin for error in a tightly contested division is going to be tiny, really, really tiny. So to me, one of the biggest questions, maybe the biggest question about this team is going to be about defense and about managing. And I'm the guy that always kind of downplays the importance of a manager. But the reality is, top to bottom, this team doesn't have a lot of guys who are going to start on a regular basis who are good with the glove, right? Joey Votto's not a very good defensive first baseman. Mike Moustakas is not exactly going to remind you of Brandon Phillips. The Reds are possibly going to start a guy who used to be a catcher at shortstop. And now Eugenio Suarez is fine. It's not making you forget about Scott Rowland. And there's some dudes in the outfield whose gloves are horrid. Now, they're probably going to be pretty good behind the plate. Tucker Barnhart was a Gold Glove winner last year. But what I want to know, for a team that's not likely to score an overabundance of runs, that very well could play in a lot of one- and two-run games, how does their defense shrink or widen their margin for error? How many outs will they give away? How many runs will they give away? How many bases will they give away? And it's not just errors. Defense, baseball defense is sometimes, you know, a guy takes a base because a throw back into the infield is lazy or off or it goes to the wrong base. That kind of thing, right? How many outs are turned into hits where in the box score the next day, you don't see an error, but it's a hit because somebody just simply couldn't get there? That is, to me, going to be really one of the more interesting things about this team. And I remember going back to before the pandemic last year, saying about this team, God, I think their starting staff could be really good, and I think they're going to hit. Their defense, top to bottom, I don't know. And what the Reds will tell you, and I believe this, by the way, to a degree, it's still not a staff that gives up a lot of contact. Mahle and Gray and Castillo all averaged over 11 strikeouts per nine innings last year, so even losing Trevor Bauer, you still have a starting staff that's not going to give up a ton of contact. Also, this is sort of emblematic of just how baseball is right now, right? Like, more hitters than ever are either hitting the ball over the wall, walking, or striking out. Those things really don't involve defense. And the Reds are pretty good. They've made an investment in doing this. The Reds have been pretty good for a while, actually, at positioning players so that more balls are hit right at guys. At the same time, let's be honest, there's some dudes. Nick Castellanos is a below-average defensive outfielder. Jesse Winker, for all the strides he made last year as a hitter, is a below-average defender in left field. Nick Senzel, I don't know. Shogo Akiyama's pretty good, but I don't know how often he's going to play. That, to me, you know, if you got a team that could just mash, that could just rake, if you have a top-end starting staff, this is perhaps not as important. For this team this year, could be vital. And let's face it, if they're going to contend, and that's still the goal here, if they're going to contend and they're going to win the National League Central or they're going to eke into the playoffs, chances are it's going to be by a very slim margin.
where one or two or maybe three games makes the difference. Well, within those one or two or three games, what do the Reds do with their gloves? What do the Reds do when they're in the field? And the other part of this is David Bell. You often hear, managers really only affect 5 or 10 games. Okay. I am usually the first person. When a team stinks, I blame the manager after everybody else. And when a team's good, I kind of credit the manager after everybody else. I think in the grand scheme of things, the manager doesn't matter that much. Dusty Baker did a good job and had a lot to do with the Reds winning, but not as much as he had really good players. And Brian Price, sure, at times looked like he didn't know what he was doing, but yeah, I mean, good players. And David Bell had better players last year than Brian Price did, so David Bell went to the postseason. At the same time, with a team that on paper is maybe not quite as good, with a starting staff the top to bottom is probably not as good, with a bullpen that is probably not as deep, with the margin for error for this team being really small, your decisions panning out, your decision-making being sound, your decision-making being logical, and your decision-making providing the results that everybody is looking for has never been more important. I know these are parts of the team that it's hard to quantify. You and I can't say today, well, here's how many errors they're going to make, or here's how bad they're going to be in the field, or here's how many bases they're going to give away, and it's kind of hard to say. I think some of the criticisms that David Bell gets are a little bit unfair. But look, this team, this manager is going to maybe have to squeeze a little bit more out of it than it's capable of getting on its own if this team's going to win. And that's, again, still the idea this year. The Reds aren't moving into rebuild mode. They're going to try to contend, even though the front office didn't help them this year, even though the front office didn't help David Bell. Those two things, to me, are going to be really worth paying attention to as we do this season day in and day out, sifting through. In close games, how did defense hurt or help? Or how did a decision that David Bell made hurt or help? Work out or blow up in his face? Worth paying attention to all season long. You'll hear from David Bell in a couple of minutes, 17 after 3. Phone numbers are 513-749-1530 and 866-702-3776. You are encouraged to follow me on Twitter, @MoEgger1530. Tweet me. I like getting tweets. We're done at 5:30 today. Papa John's weekend tip-off. We'll do some college basketball in 15 minutes on ESPN 1530 Cincinnati Sports Station. 23 after 3, this is ESPN 1530. My name's Mo Egger. Blog is at ESPN1530.com. Podcast page at ESPN1530.com is where we put old shows and interviews. Including Eric got a request today for the Eric Davis interview. Eric Davis interview from 2 weeks ago. It's on the podcast page at ESPN1530.com, which is, by the way, available for sponsorship. I was talking about David Bell before, and I think terms like hot seat are a little bit overused, but there's a couple of things about him that I think are interesting. One is the simple fact he goes into the last guaranteed year of his deal. He does have a team option for 2022, the expectation, and I genuinely think that ownership still expects to win this year, despite the cost-cutting of the roster, despite what they've done to cut into it. Like, I still think the expectation is going to be in 2021 to at least do what they did last year and hopefully even beyond that, win in the postseason, get to the postseason, and then win in the postseason. Might seem like an unrealistic expectation, but I think it's an expectation. So there's that. There's also the fact that David Bell was hired by Dick Williams. Nick Kroll was involved in the process, but David Bell, the person who signed off on hiring David Bell, is no longer here. How much protection that affords David Bell or would have afforded David Bell, I don't know. But you've got a manager who has not really won anything going into the last guaranteed year of his deal. Ownership expecting to win, and the person that hired David Bell no longer an active part of the baseball operation, you do wonder what that's going to mean for him if they don't win this year. Now, win is sort of an open-ended term, but you do kind of wonder. And so there's all of that, and then there's just a roster itself that is top to bottom, doesn't have the depth and the strength that maybe it might have had at the beginning of last year, right? Like, that bullpen is probably on paper, at least, not quite as good. And so, you know, last year, David Bell is juggling, you know, what to do in the bullpen with Raisel Iglesias. And at the end of the year, even though he barely used him, with R.G. Bradley. There's still some really good arms there. So a microscope on his decision-making during a season after which there's no guarantee that he's back, while he's working for an owner who I'm sure expects to win, and directly beneath somebody who wasn't the main point person in hiring him, I think that adds a few layers to David Bell. I've got something else here that sort of comes from the somewhat conspiratorial side of me that I can't help but get out of my head. I'll give you that here in just a second. But first, pitchers and catchers are working out in a good year. So here is David Bell talking about Hunter Green, some of the young guys throwing here early in spring training, Tucker Barnhart's role with some of them, and more.
Well, I guess what happened to Brandon Bailey that he needed Tommy John, when did that go down?
Yeah, I got to meet him in person for the first time yesterday, and he was pretty devastated. And the reason was is he really feels like he's letting, you know, the team down in the organization, which I quickly made sure he knew that that wasn't the case. And just a really, really thoughtful and really nice person. Felt for him, obviously, going through this, coming to a new organization. He was very excited to be here. But we both spoke of, it'll be a different story a year from now. We'll look back at this conversation and we'll have all this behind him, and we'll do everything we can to support him. But he felt great, he said, all winter, and it just kind of came out of nowhere. So he loved where he was at, and you know, it's really difficult, you know, and you see him have to go through that. But on the other hand, we have a great team in place here to help him through it, and we'll stick by his side to help him make it and get back on the mound pitching for us, hopefully.
David, it looked like a lot of the younger guys went yesterday through those bullpens. Did you see anything? You know, I guess it's kind of nice to see Hunter Green, speaking of Tommy John, it's a high profile guy, just to kind of see him and some of those other guys out on the mound. And what was that like, just to get some eyes on some of those guys?
Yeah. First of all, it was great to see everyone. And I didn't even, you know, it's different, right? It's a little bit, we're spread out. I didn't even get around to see every player or coach in person yesterday. So hopefully complete that process today. I know that the sides went well. One of my strategies I'll let you in on here is usually the first bullpen or two that our guys throw, I kind of intentionally just kind of stay out of the way. I know it's a big day, and you know, I've experienced this myself, where you come out the first day and you have all these eyes on you, and you maybe try to make the team on day one. So really just try to do my part of kind of letting them settle in. Not that, you know, my eyes would necessarily, you know, push them, you know, too far or anything like that, but it's just something I've always done. So I didn't really get a close look yesterday, but from all reports, everyone looked healthy. Some guys, you know, threw extremely well, which, you know, is good. But, you know, we did have an opportunity to remind guys again today that, don't try to do too much, you know, because that adrenaline kicks in even on day one. You've been throwing all winter, but it's just different being outside and, you know, having the uniform on.
What do you look for in a guy like Tucker Barnhart this season, just knowing that, you know, he might be paired with a rookie catcher, no longer Kirk Casale, and obviously Gold Glove defender, but just what are you hoping to see from him this season?
Yeah, just continuing to do what he has done for his whole career. You know, I've gotten to see him close the last couple of years, and he continues to improve defensively as a catcher. You know, he continues to, improve offensively. He's just become a better player. Like he quietly just continues to be not only a solid player for us, but really consistently now for several years, one of the best catchers in our league. When you look at it, and there's a lot that goes into that, not just stats, but you know, the intangibles and the way he's developed relationships with our catchers and the adjustments he's made, you know, with his receiving and framing. I mean, I could go on and on. He's a huge part of this team in every way. So, you know, one adjustment he made a couple years ago was going to all left-handed hitting. So, we'll, you know, hopefully we'll have more opportunity this year, given the way the camp is structured, to get him more bats against left-handers. But we're really excited about both of those guys, you know, making up a great team. And, you know, it always helps that one hits right-handed and one hits left-handed. Just one more way to make it a little bit easier to get them both a lot of playing time.
David Bell, earlier today, you heard him talk about Brandon Bailey. And if you don't remember, the Reds acquired him in November in a trade with the Houston Astros. He made his big league debut last year with Houston. He is 26 years old. It's actually going to be the second time that he has had Tommy John surgery. He underwent that procedure in high school, and he didn't pitch his senior year. Still went on to pitch in college, went on to be drafted by the Oakland A's, ultimately went over to the Houston Astros, and last year pitched in five games and statistically at least gave up just two runs in seven and a third. A guy right in what should be the prime, beginning the prime of his career, 26 years old, Tommy John surgery for him. So he will not pitch for the Reds in 2021. I am late. We'll get to the sort of conspiratorial part of me that I can't shake when it comes to David Bell and a very important stretch for one area coach on ESPN 1530 Cincinnati Sports Station.
ESPN 1530. The Cincinnati Bengals play here.
Sports updates in service of Kelsey Chevrolet, home of lifetime powertrain protection and guaranteed credit approval from their family to yours for life. Go to KelseyChev.com. I mentioned Brandon Bailey needs Tommy John surgery. Pitcher acquired from the Reds from the Astros in November. A guy short on big league experience. Nonetheless, a tough blow for him. One other thing, and this had been rumored. The Reds, baseball may have made this official, and if they have, my apologies for giving you something you already know, but the Reds sent this out today, so I figured I would read it. In spring training, and the Reds will play the first spring training game a week from Sunday. Games that begin, the games that occur from the beginning of spring training through March 13th will be scheduled as seven-inning games, but upon mutual agreement of both managers, may be shortened to five-inning games or lengthened to nine-inning games. So the first couple of weeks, the games are going to be scheduled to be seven innings. Managers could agree to shorten them to five. They could also agree to lengthen them to nine. Games that occur on or after March 14th, so March 14th on, shall be nine-inning games, but upon mutual agreement of both managers can be shortened to seven-inning games. Clubs who want to modify its scheduled game length will have to notify MLB on or before 5 p.m. the day before the game. So that'll be an interesting wrinkle. What I want to know, if you go to spring training, because they're having a limited number of fans, and you buy a ticket to the game, do you pay like 77% of a nine-inning game if you're only going to go see a seven-inning baseball game? Are they cutting off beer sales after five? When do beer sales get cut off for a five-inning baseball game? Are they selling beer? I mean, got to be selling some beer, right? I mean, even if there's only, you know, a few people in the ballpark, you sell a cold beer. Five-inning baseball game, they shutting off the taps after four? Taryn, this is the kind of stuff I need you to find. This is important. College basketball tonight on ESPN 1530. Good one in the Horizon League. NKU and Wright State tipping off at 6 p.m., you'll hear it with the pregame show starting at 5:30 on ESPN 1530. Same two teams tomorrow at 6. That game tomorrow airs on Fox Sports 1360. Also tonight, Dayton hosting St. Louis. Flyers beat the Billikens the first go-around. Tomorrow in the area, Kentucky battles Tennessee. Wildcats have won two straight games. That game at 1 o'clock tomorrow on ESPN 1530. Miami's at Northern Illinois. Indiana hosting Michigan on Sunday. The game between UC and Houston, John Brannon says, is still on. Obviously, there are issues with a lot of places and a lot of people dealing with the power being turned off. Weather has been a problem. It's a mess in Texas, but the game in Houston is still on. That tips off at 1 p.m. on Sunday. Xavier will host Butler, and a really good one on Sunday afternoon, pitting number 3 Michigan and 4th-rated Ohio State. 20 minutes away from 4. A couple of things on all that real quick. We'll get to the Bearcats a little bit later on. You'll hear from John Brandon. Xavier's game on Sunday is big. This is a big stretch, I think, for Travis Steele. And not that I think if things fall apart here over the next couple of weeks that Travis is in any danger of losing his gig. But, you know, let's be honest. When last season ended, Xavier was not going to go to the NCAA tournament in all likelihood. And the year kind of petered out with those last two regular season losses and losing to DePaul and the season being another non-tournament year for the Musketeers. Year one, Xavier didn't go to the NCAA tournament. This year, a week ago at this time, you would have looked at their record and said 11-2, they're going to make it. And I believe they're going to be fine. I think if you look at 4 of their next 5 games, you can make the argument they should be favored in all of them. They have a great chance for a really good win at home against Creighton. The strength of the Big East, relatively speaking, has not been what it usually is. I think they're going to be fine. I think they're going to hold serve. I think they go 3-2 the rest of the way. It kind of feels like they're going to be okay. And they have in their back pocket one of the best wins in all of college basketball, which is that win over Oklahoma. But, you know, you got to a point late last season where they lost a game at Providence, and you went, okay, going into that game, if you take care of business in this one, they're good. And they didn't. You go, okay, you got to win the home finale, the last game of the season, in the regular season against Butler. Win that one, and they're good. And they didn't. Then, okay, you know what? Now there's pressure on what you got to do in New York, and they played DePaul, and they didn't win that game. And when that game ended, we kind of came to the realization that it ain't going to matter because there's not going to be an NCAA tournament, but still, they wouldn't have made it. I think Travis Steele needs to avoid a similar fate this year, if for no other reason, just to de-intensify the heat that would be on him in that program next year. Xavier basketball, they don't miss the tournament consecutive years. They certainly don't miss the tournament in 3 consecutive years, and you can't miss a tournament when you're really in the driver's seat. And look, COVID's been an issue, and it's every program in the country has had to deal with COVID to different degrees, and it's caused havoc with the schedule. What I worry about is I don't know how you – they're not a good defensive team. They certainly were awful on Tuesday. You could expect them to improve incrementally, but I don't know how you go from playing the way they did on defense their last 2 games and really expected to improve that significantly. Now, the good news is offensively, they're going to be okay. And Travis Steele said that yesterday. But I just don't think you want to be in a position where you have to go to New York and win a game. Who knows even how that looks? Who knows even how that unfolds? And so they've got the safety net of a good record. I think most bracketologists would have them safely in the tournament. Butler's a Q3 game. You don't want to drop that and place more emphasis on the games you have in front of you. Butler probably being easier than all of them. Simply put, they can't fall apart after starting 11-2 and miss the NCAA tournament and have people feel comfortable about 3 straight years of Xavier not making it. Hopefully they end their 2-game losing streak and get a win on Sunday night and quiet whatever conversation there is about not making the dance. I am interested in what the defensive improvements are if we see them and how dramatic they are. One thing here on David Bell. So I'm happy Barry Larkin is in the Reds TV booth, and I believe him wholeheartedly, 100%. When he says he is not taking this job, angling to be the Reds manager. He said on a Zoom call the other day when he was introduced, as if Barry Larkin needs any introduction, when he was introduced as a Reds analyst on Fox Sports Ohio, he said, well, look, I said some things a couple of years ago that people interpreted, I'm paraphrasing him here, interpreted as you know, me wanting Brian Price's job, and maybe that's not what he meant, but it certainly is how it came across, and I could tell you that it didn't go over well with people like, you know, Brian Price. Or Barry, as the Reds had a manager, was telling people, I want to be the Reds manager. That doesn't do anybody any good, especially when you're a legend, especially when you're a fan favorite, especially when you're a Hall of Famer. So maybe his approach now is, I'm not interested in being the Reds manager, at least right now. He certainly left open the door to managing one day. but he has said, I'm taking this job to work in TV, be a part of the organization. I want to be really good at this. He's done a really good work as done really good work as a broadcaster before, and I think he's going to be great on Reds games on Fox Sports Ohio, and I genuinely believe that he has taken this job to be a broadcaster and nothing else. At the same time, understanding how this club operates at the top, the way most of us do, would it totally stun you? Would it totally stun you if ownership, looking at David Bell, hearing some public dissatisfaction with him, maybe at the end of this year, remember, next year's team is probably going to look a lot like it, right? Look at all the guys who are under contract for 2022. There's some immovable parts. Nobody's going to want Mike Moustakas. Nobody's going to want Joey Votto if they fail. Needing a little bit of a public jolt, needing something to get people excited about, and perhaps with some level of dissatisfaction with David Bell. I wonder, with the fact that Barry's now around the team a lot more in the broadcast booth, raises his public profile, perhaps makes him as popular as he's ever been. I wonder if ownership would be more inclined to just make him the manager at that point than they ever have been. I don't think Barry has taken the job to be the Reds manager one day. I do wonder how, however, if in his new role, he is a more attractive candidate for people that would be doing the hiring, specifically the owner. 14 from 4. At Mo Egger 1530 is how you hit me up on Twitter. I've talked over the last maybe week and a half about a degree of optimism when it comes to the Reds, and I'll give you what it's based on, or actually what I think it should be based on for you coming up at 4:05. And there's two things I'm not doing when it comes to the Bengals and the draft that I don't think you should either. We'll do that at 4:20. It's 13 minutes away from 4 o'clock. We'll get to the biggest question in college basketball next on ESPN 1530 Cincinnati Sports Station. 9 away from 4 o'clock. This is ESPN 1530. I wish I could tell you what I'm laughing at. I just saw something on Twitter right before the light went on. Oh, man. You know what we should do is talk to somebody on the phone, like a caller, like a listener, instead of me just rambling on about God knows what. So let's chat with Eddie in Western Hills. Hi, Eddie.
Hi, Mo. How you doing, man?
I'm really good. What's up?
Great, man. Get ready to start for the weekend.
I hear that.
Just wanted to touch base on the Reds, the 2021 season coming up. I know every year around this time, you always do your predictions just as far as, you know, how many wins, over and under.
Yeah.
I'm sticking with the 78, between 78 and 82 wins.
Yeah.
I mean, I hope I'm wrong, but like you say, this team is a little bit worse than what it was last year. They lost a couple of key pieces. Salvador, which we knew wasn't coming back even 4 months ago. They still don't have a shortstop. That was the number one need in the offseason. I remember Nick Kroll saying, yeah, our number one need is to get a shortstop. Well, February 19th, and we still don't have a legit shortstop. They decided not to use Nick Senzel there about a year or two ago when he came up. I think, you know, he has no position on this team right now. Like you said, you know, we know Castellanos is playing right field. We know Shogo is going to get majority of the starts in center. You know, he should play every day.
Yeah.
I think Winker will probably get majority of the playing time as well with his bat against righties. They lost Archie Bradley. I mean, they traded away Rossell Iglesias. They saved about $1 million there, and they sort of kept going on not bringing back Kurt Casale, you know, Brian Goodwin, and Archie Bradley, which I wish they would have kept Archie Bradley somehow.
Likewise.
But this bullpen is just a little bit weaker than what it was last year. This team would not have made the playoffs last year if not for the expanded playoffs,
mm-hmm.
given it was a 60-game season, though, but still.
Yeah.
You know, still didn't perform as well as they should have last year in 60 games sample size. And like you said, this year they got worse. You know, you got Castillo, you got Gray, and then Mallory, I think, took a step forward last year. But after that, you know, the back in the rotation seems a little questionable. You know, can Wade Miley stay healthy? Can he be effective? Who's that fifth star going to be? I mean, right now you think it'd be Michael Lorenzen, but can he go, you know, deep into games consistently? The offense has been horrible the last 2 years. last year was horrible. 2019 it was horrible. I remember 2019 when they had those 30-something one-run losses.
Yeah, yeah.
So what gives us any indication this offense is going to be good this year? I thought that last year. Well, they're going to bounce back. They can't be bad 2 years in a row. Well, they proved me wrong.
Yeah, I mean, look, I agree with everything you've said. I guess for me, from an offensive standpoint, part of it's collectively, I find it hard to believe they're going to be as bad. And luck has a lot to do with that. Some guys having underperforming seasons. The fact that it was just, you know, a two-month sprint. I certainly don't think this is going to be a high-end offense that just is a, you know, a juggernaut. But I think this collectively they're going to hit better. They're going to hit more. Some of these guys are going to have better seasons. I think a big key to that is Senzel plus Shogo, to what extent he plays. You know, he got on base at just a torrid clip at the end of last year. I kind of suspect that Tyler Stevenson's going to represent a little bit of an offensive upgrade from Kirk Casale, and obviously they want him to play a lot, so that's maybe going to help. But no, you're right. I mean, offensively, they're at best going to be kind of middle of the pack. It's going to have to be the strength of the starting staff. I guess what I kind of hang my hat on is the front three. Tyler Mahle had a better ERA last year than Sonny Gray. Tyler Mahle had the second best walks and hits per innings pitch ratio on the entire staff. If I can get, you know, 31, 32 starts apiece from those three guys, I think that's a pretty good jumping off point. Now, the Wade Miley thing, I don't know. Michael Lorenzen, I don't know. TJ Antone, I don't know. I do think if you were to look at similarly placed kind of middle of the pack teams, though, there are a lot of squads that would like to have those three guys competing for their final two spots in the rotation. And as much as I wish they would have kept the bullpen intact, you could still throw hopefully a healthy Lucas Sims at people and Amir Garrett at people, and whoever doesn't make the rotation from Antone and Lorenzen, you could throw them at people. I mean, there's still options, but not as many. It's hard to imagine them winning more than somewhere in the mid-80s, but if you can get there, that could get it done in this division this year.
Yeah, I think that's one thing the Reds got in their favor, is they're in the right division right now. This is the one division that's actually up for grabs. The Pirates are rebuilding. They're not going to be in. They're going to be in last place. I mean, the Cubs lost Yu Darvish, and they lost John Lester, and they lost a couple other players. I think Kyle Schwarber. I don't think the Cubs are going to be in the first place. I think it's going to come down to whoever has that, like you said, that just whoever performs in that division. The Cardinals, the Brewers, the Reds. I do want to thank you, though, Mo, for yesterday's show. So you had me laughing. Oh, my God. I was laughing so hard in my car when you were laughing about the Padres can go out and spend a gazillion dollars on a player, Fernando Tatis Jr., but the Reds were unable to just go out there and spend a little more money on just a shortstop. That's all they needed was a shortstop.
Yeah, yeah.
That would help their biggest hole has been shortstop, and they did not fill that. And that would also would help their offense a little bit, too, had they got another shortstop that could hit.
You know, look, ownership had a role in it, but Nick Kroll is the public face of the Reds baseball operation, and his one major task he failed at, which was go get a shortstop. He's acknowledged that. We tried to go get a shortstop. We didn't. And now we're going to sift through Kyle Holder and Kyle Farmer and Jose Garcia. It's really, really frustrating. It's really, really frustrating. Now, I don't know that any of the guys that they would have signed would have made me feel drastically better about this team, but it is a bigger hole than the one they started with last year, and I think everybody would have agreed that shortstop was probably not going to be a strength of the team last year. I appreciate it, man. Are you still working at Kroger?
Yes, sir. Right. I've not seen you there for a while, though.
You would have seen us there on Saturday. It was 2.5 hours. I was looking for you.
Oh, I'm doing the quick list now where you shop for the customers. But I would have still probably seen you, though. I'd
have you over my house then. All right. Eddie, thanks, man.
Thanks, man. Have a good weekend.
You'd do the same. It's 4 o'clock. I'm going to give you some stuff that happened during last year that you can maybe hang your hat on if you're a Reds fan. And the one thing I don't believe in doing from a Bengals draft perspective, and I didn't get to this, I was supposed to, the biggest question looming over college basketball and little John Brandon as well. Done at 5:30 today. It's almost 4 o'clock. This is ESPN 1530, Cincinnati Sports Station.
No one covers the Bengals like ESPN 1530, Cincinnati's sports station.
There you go. It's 5 minutes after 4. This is ESPN 1530. Hi, how you doing? Hey, I'm Mo Egger. Are you a canopy crazy? The Bengals had a new thing for season ticket holders, and if you could be one of the Canopy Crazies, get a Canopy Crazies t-shirt. Canopy Crazy. Canopy Crazy. There you go. Good luck. Let's see. Papa John's weekend tip-off in over an hour. NKU and Wright State at 5:30. Some NFL/Bengals stuff coming up at 4:20. There's things I see sometimes on television that I wish I could comment on. This is probably not one of those things that I would be able to get away with commenting on. But wow. Let me just do this here on the Reds and like it's funny over the last couple of weeks I've been accused by some of being too negative, and you know that's because I've asked questions like, hey, why can't the Reds spend money on players like other teams? And, you know, talking about how the front office, the payroll slashing has on paper made the team maybe not as good as the one that walked off the field at the end of the season last year in Atlanta. And then, you know, I've also been accused of being too positive, an apologist for the Reds, because I don't think they're going to be a terrible team. Like, I think late in the year, this team's going to be playing some pretty meaningful baseball, because I don't think anybody else in this division is very good. I think the National League Central could come down to which of the other four teams that aren't the Pirates beats the hell the most out of the Pirates. By the way, the Pirates have reportedly signed Todd Frazier. Todd Frazier, who since he left the Reds has played for the White Sox, the Yankees, the Mets, the Rangers, and then went back to the Mets. He's played for like 1,000 teams since he left Cincinnati. Todd Frazier just turned 35 years old now with the Pirates on a minor league contract. So good luck to him. Good luck to him. He has not played for a National League Central team since leaving Cincinnati last year. Hit .236 with four home runs in 45 games between Texas and New York. So I don't allow the stagnant sort of spin their tires off season to lead me to a place where now I think the Reds are doomed to finish with the kind of record that they had almost every single year from 2014 through 2019. This is a better baseball team. Maybe not better than last year's team, but it's better than most of those, maybe all of those that I just mentioned. And I do think to a degree, as easy as it is to get hung up on who they lost, and I wish Trevor Bauer was here. I wish Raisel Iglesias was here. I wish Archie Bradley were here. I wish the shortstop situation was better. I wish Joey Votto was still 29 years old. I mean, there's a lot of things I wish for that I can't have. At the same time, I also feel like some of the pessimism is not as much based on what the Reds haven't done this offseason. I think part of it's based on some individual underperformance from last year. Right? Like, I kind of think there are folks who thought that Nick Castellanos and Mike Moustakas have been better players than they've actually been. That's not to say that they've been bad players. Mike Moustakas has made all-star teams. Nick Castellanos is one of the better Detroit Tigers in recent years, although that's not saying all that much. Those are quality big league players. But, you know, the Reds didn't acquire either guy thinking these dudes are going to be MVP candidates or even all-star starters at their respective positions. They were guys who were still productive, guys who had a lot left in the tank, and guys who were upgrades from the players that they basically replaced. But it feels like last season those two guys were disappointments. In reality, Nick Castellanos' numbers were not that much of a departure from what he's been his entire career. Mike Moustakas' OPS last season was 46 points higher than his career OPS. Like, those dudes were not awful. Moustakas missed some time. 16 games in a 60-game season is a huge chunk of games. Joey Votto wasn't very good. Joey Votto is declining. That's just the statistical reality. He's declined from what he was in 2017. Since then, every single year he's been in decline. Eugenio Suarez had, on many levels, a bad year. Hit .202. OPS took a plummet. Still hit a bunch of home runs. At the same time, and so it's easy to kind of frame how you feel about the team based on, well, last year some guys underachieved, or last year some guys didn't meet, you know, expectations, even if some of those expectations were unrealistic. But when you look, I think when you do a little bit of a deeper look, not even that deep of a look, but when you do a look into what happened on the field last year, I think there are some things that can make you feel pretty good about 2020. Like, Jesse Winker... It happened last year, what we had been waiting forever, right? Jesse Winker hit. He was this team's best offensive player. Pike mentioned it on Cincy 360 today. He was the behind Trevor Bauer, second on the team in wins above replacement. He was their best offensive player. Now, he might have been their best offensive player in large part because nobody else was any good. And, you know, let's be honest, his production last season was largely based on an absolutely unbelievable August. He wasn't quite as good in September, but it was, if you look at the overall statistical profile, it's pretty good. And by the way, this is a guy, if you're looking at OPS, and again, it's just one number, 859 his career. He's hit with some power at 12 homers in 54 games last year. You would call, I think, for a 26-year-old who we've talked about forever, wondering what kind of player is he going to be? How does he fit in? Jesse Winker had a good 2020. You would call last season for him a success. He was a reason, a big reason why they actually got to the playoffs. So can I expect Jesse Winker to have another good year? I'd like to think so. Tyler Mahle, I've cited this a couple of different times. Tyler Mahle did not pitch as many innings last year as Sonny Gray, basically nine fewer. We all love Sonny Gray, right? Love Sonny, possible staff ace. Sonny Gray last year, ERA 370. Tyler Mahle, 359. Now, there's all sorts of flaws with the statistic of ERA. And there are many metrics in which Sonny Gray was better. At the same time, walks and hits per innings pitch, that ratio, Tyler Mahle had the second best on the staff, only behind the National League Cy Young Award winner. Tyler Mahle gave up fewer hits per nine innings than both Sonny Gray and Luis Castillo. Tyler Mahle gave up home runs at the exact same rate as Trevor Bauer. Tyler Mahle walked fewer batters per nine innings than Sonny Gray did. I'm not telling you Tyler Mahle is better than Sonny Gray. I'm certainly not telling you he's better than Trevor Bauer. I'm definitely not telling you he's better than Luis Castillo. But right behind those two guys, he's a pretty damn good number three. I think Tyler Mahle, I've always said this about the 2012 team, that staff, Johnny Cueto made a leap that year. Matt Latos was really good. But beyond that, there were just a bunch of guys that night, if I said Homer Bailey's pitching, you felt like, you know what, the Reds can win. If I said to you Mike Leake is pitching, you went, you know what, the Mike Leake's on tonight? Yes, the Reds can win that game. Then there was this huge stretch from 16, 17, 18, even much of 15, where whoever was throwing that night, it's like, yeah, they're not winning tonight. Like this whole cycle of Scott Feldmans and Andrew Wojciechowski's, and which, by the way, is my favorite guy. All these dudes, Lee Silverto, Bonilla, the corpse of Bronson Arroyo when they brought him back. Like all these guys, they rolled in. And every time you'd say, well, the corpse of Bronson Arroyo is going to pitch tonight, well, they're not going to win. If Luis Castillo, Sonny Gray, and Tyler Mahle are starting, I think you believe that night they've got a shot to win. And so you kind of forget Tyler Mahle. Last year was a major, major step forward for him. By the way, you know what else? Kind of, sort of, in a very brief, tiny time frame, lived up to the hype? Tyler Stevenson. Tyler Stevenson has been regarded as at least the Reds' best catching prospect since Devin Mesoraco, and some might say even before. Now, you're going to go, wait a minute, tiny, tiny, tiny sample size. And it was. He had 20 plate appearances. He played in eight games. But you certainly didn't see a guy who looked overmatched. You certainly didn't see a guy who looked lost at the plate. And you didn't see a guy who looked like he was a negative behind the plate. And in terms of working with pitchers and calling a game and guiding a staff, is there anybody better to learn from than Tucker Barnhart? A guy like Kirk Casale did a nice job here, and the Reds had a nice little catching tandem. Limited offensively, because Tucker Barnhart's not a good hitter. He has talked about remaking his swing, but Tyler Stevenson, they really like him. And in these tiny little glimpses of him last year, there was a lot to like. The name T.J. Antone. T.J. Antone's 2000. 2020 was a smashing success for a guy that nobody talked about at the beginning of the year last year. When he started, he was fine. When he came out of the bullpen, he was better than fine. That dude's going to have a role on this team, either getting important outs out of the bullpen or starting. Like, there's something to build on. And the reason I bring up some of these things is you could look at, well, Suarez had a bad year last year, so what do I get this year? I don't know. I think Suarez bounces back. Or you could look at some of the guys individually and say, man, they didn't do all that much. But within that season last year, and small sample size of 60 games, and you might say, well, look, I want to see it over the course of 162 games. Fine. But then I could also say, for example, Eugenio Suarez, he had a bad 2 months. Who's to say if that's a 162-game season that his numbers don't significantly improve? And maybe you could say that about a handful of guys on that team. If you're going to use the bad results last year to add to the discontent you feel about the Reds, then I do think you have to look at some of the good stuff that unfolded last year to counter it. Not to be fair or anything, just because there was some good stuff last year, and I don't think this team's going to be awful. And I wish the bar was higher than that. By the way, Luis Castillo, his last 9 starts, Luis Castillo in September was money. And he didn't pitch poorly in game 2 of the postseason either. His last 9 starts, his ERA was 2.72. But there was some stuff to like that could make you think that the guys who gave you the stuff to like could help this team at least stay in the hunt this year. I don't know if Tyler Stevenson, the 20 at-bats that he got last season, how to translate that to, you know, what he's going to do this year. He's obviously sharing time with Tucker Barnhart. He is kind of a rookie, although not officially. And so there's going to be some growing pains there. But if you watched him, you looked at a guy, that dude's ready for the big leagues. That dude looked better than Kirk Casale last year. Tyler Malley looked the part of, like, bona fide, middle of the rotation, just anchor who's going to give you a good start almost every single time. Jesse Winker was their best offensive player last year. TJ Antone looked like a guy who could be a part of the solution. On Luis Castillo, we slobbered over Trevor Bauer in September. You know, go back and remember at the end of the year last year, Luis Castillo came up big in some games the Reds absolutely had to have. You remember that game in St. Louis where he went 9 innings, which you never see a complete game, and it just looked like that night he put the team on his back? I think that was a Friday night game against the Cardinals. Goes the distance. Followed that up with the 10 strikeout game against the Pirates. Followed that up with what felt like a must win against Milwaukee. Gave up just a run. They don't go to the playoffs without him. There's a lot to build on there for a guy who's right in the middle of his prime and years of team control. So it ain't optimism just for the sake of optimism. It's not pessimism just for the sake of pessimism. And there's optimistic vibes, I think, based on a handful of good things that did happen. You don't agree, that's completely cool. And again, I don't think this team's going to be great. Hate what's happened this offseason. Don't like the theme of payroll slashing. Also, don't think things are as dire as many. And it's based on some of these small things that did go down last year. You're welcome to tell me what you think at 513-749-1530 and 866-702-3776. I have done what Tony Pike... I'm sorry. I haven't done what Tony Pike has. I will explain better than that next on ESPN 1530 Cincinnati Sports Station. 22 after 4. This is ESPN 1530. I'm Mo Egger. You can tweet me during the show and also after the show. Though maybe tomorrow might be a Twitter-free day for this guy. You know what I mean? Might be a Twitter-free day for your friend Mo. But I'll be back on Sunday because we have Bearcat basketball. We'll see. See how I feel. See how tonight goes. 513-749-1530 and 866-702-3776. I was listening to Tony Pike on Cincy 360, and we were going to do this in the first hour, and then we got off onto other topics. And so he carried forth without me in the second hour of the show, where I asked him off air, have you developed any, like, strong opinions about the Bengals draft? And he said, yes, he doesn't want them to take Penei Sewell. He also doesn't want them to take Kyle Pitts with the 5th pick. And I don't necessarily disagree with that. If you traded back to get him, I think he's there, not that far back. With the 5th pick overall, I boil it down to something that Paul Daner Jr. wrote in The Athletic this week, which was, or last week, I should say, which was, if you're enamored with him as a receiver, go and get a receiver. Go and get somebody who can take the top off of defense. Go and get somebody who fixes what Joe Burrow has even said is something this team has to improve upon, which is beating teams downfield, throwing the deep ball. Kyle Pitts, for as much as he is an absolute physical specimen, for as good of an NFL player as he projects to be, I'm not sure he does that. Now, if he's on your team, that's cool. I would wonder if you can put him on your team with the sixth pick, where the Eagles are, or maybe even a little bit after that. The Penei Sewell thing, this is remarkable to me. I know this isn't the first time that I've said this, but in December, when the Bengals beat the Pittsburgh Steelers on Monday Night Football, I heard folks who sounded like they were going to hang themselves because the Bengals couldn't take Penei Sewell. Why? Well, because he's like Anthony Munoz. And I'm going, okay, you never saw Anthony Munoz play. It's an unfair comparison. To now, here we are, basically 2 months later, and you can find folks who want the Bengals to run in the other direction. I don't know. Here's where I admit that I kind of struggle with this whole process this year. Specifically, Penei Sewell is interesting to me because there's a lot of people who think he's that good. I'm interested in how personnel people factor in the caliber of opponents in the Pac-12 and how the year off factors into the consensus of the National Football League. Now, Bengals still may have him at the top of their draft board, but the Penei Sewell thing for me, the offensive line thing for me, and I'm guessing for you as well, has always hinged on what do they do in free agency first? Like, what's the thing in free agency first of all? Who are they getting? Are they whiffing in free agency? If they don't address their offensive line with, like, top-end talent, not settling for, like, the third or fourth tier guys, top-end talent, and Penei Sewell's there with the fifth overall pick, you almost have to take him. Now, Rashawn Slater, arguments could be made for him. There's Christian Darrisaw, arguments could be made for him as well. There are personnel people who have had Rashawn Slater ranked higher than Penei Sewell. But if he's on your board higher than those guys and you've whiffed in free agency, if you've basically done on the offensive line what the Reds tried to do at shortstop, and you understand that this franchise stops if Joe Burrow is hurt, it's suddenly a need becomes an even bigger and more burning need. Maybe it's not Penei Sewell. Maybe if you're Duke Tobin, your evaluation, your franchise's evaluation says Rashawn Slater is better, and if that's the case, go ahead and pull the trigger on him. I'm not going to pretend to be qualified to tell you that one guy is better than the other, and frankly, most of the people you hear weighing in on the topic aren't either. I'm not going to do that, but why we're crossing anybody off the board now when we haven't even started the league year yet, I don't know. I don't get why we're crossing any possibility off the board when we haven't seen how free agency is going to affect this team in a year where there's likely to be a bunch of dudes who are let go and free to be signed because of cap casualties in the lower cap. Why we're crossing anybody off the board, I don't even know how you do a mock draft right now, quite frankly. And mock drafts get a lot of clicks, and they ignite conversation, and I'm not going to pretend like I don't look at them, because there's often really good information about the players themselves in mock drafts. So, but I don't know how you look at those things and take them that seriously, given the fact that there's still going to probably be some more player movement via trades, and we're going to have this whole month plus of time where guys are changing teams. What the Bengals do in free agency will very well impact what they do in the draft. And again, that period of time in the middle of March is going to be all about getting what they need on the offensive line. And we've talked about all the subjects since even before last season ended, all the different guys that they could get. But why we're eliminating anybody as a possibility before anybody has signed from another team? I don't know. I don't know how you do that, right? So, you know, it has to remain a possibility until it gets crossed off by what they do. signing guys from other teams. 29 minutes after 4 o'clock, 513-749-1530 and 866-702-3776 at MoEgger1530 on Twitter. You'll hear from John Brandon and you'll hear from Travis Steele coming up at 520. But first, we were talking about catchers. You'll hear from a pair and we'll get to the biggest question in college basketball all ahead on ESPN 1530 Cincinnati Sports Station. Sports headlines are a service of Kelsey Chevrolet, home of lifetime powertrain protection and guaranteed credit approval from their family to yours for life. Go to KelseyChev.com. College hoops tonight on ESPN 1530. NKU battling Wright State. That game tips off at 6. Pregame starts at 5:30. Norse have won 7 out of 8. You'll hear it live on ESPN 1530. Same two teams tomorrow on Fox Sports. 1360 also tonight. Dayton hosting St. Louis. Billikens looking for their first win at UD Arena since January of 2014. Tomorrow, Indiana hosts Michigan State. Kentucky is at Tennessee. That game airs on ESPN 1530 at 1 o'clock. Miami's at Northern Illinois Sunday. UC and Houston game is still on. Bearcats still traveling to Houston despite the power outages and all the different issues that the state of Texas is dealing with. Tip at 1 on 700 WLW. Xavier hosting Butler and Ohio State and Michigan hooking up in a battle of teams ranked 3rd and 4th in both major polls. 25 from 5. The Reds today, they sent this announcement. And I, if you knew this already, and we talked about this being a thing possibly, I guess now it is. Spring training games are going to start next weekend. The first 2 weeks of games up to and including March 13th will be scheduled as 7-inning games. But both managers, if they agree, the game could be shortened to a 5-inning game or lengthened to a 9-inning game. What we still haven't figured out, and this is the important part, if you pay for a 7-inning game, you buy a ticket in advance, and they shorten it to 5, do you get some of your money back? When do beer sales close? March 14th on to the end of spring training. Those will be 9-inning games, but upon mutual agreement of both managers, they can be shortened to 7. You buy a 9-inning ticket, you get set. What? They're important things, Taryn. By the way, how are the stupid seven-inning doubleheaders we have this year when fans can come now? How's that going to work for fans? Beer sales get shut off then. 7-inning doubleheaders. Taryn, these are the things we need. This is the important stuff. Righty Brandon Bailey, who the Reds acquired from the Astros this offseason, is going to have Tommy John surgery next week. Second time. He went through this in high school. Going through it again, unfortunately. So he is not going to pitch for Cincinnati in 2021. Catchers. Today was Catcher's Day. You want to hear some catchers? Here are some catchers. Let's begin with Tyler Stevenson. We talked about him before. Did a nice job in sort of that other catcher role. Had one of the biggest hits of the season, the walk-off against the Pirates in the first game of that doubleheader in mid-September, which kind of triggered that two-week dash to the postseason. No more Kirk Casale. Now it's Tyler Stevenson. Now it's Tucker Barnhart. You'll hear from Tucker later, but first let's hear from Tyler on moving into the de facto Kirk Casale role.
I was excited. I mean, obviously I kind of understand what that means for me. But obviously I hate that he was gone. He was great. I was just great to know him and get to just pick his brain really the past few years. And yeah, I mean, obviously I was excited just because that just opens up an opportunity for me to potentially fill his spot. And I'm looking forward to it.
The biggest thing you learned out of the alternate site last year that helped you kind of put you in position where they felt comfortable letting Kirk go and you coming in and having a chance to catch a lot more?
I know, especially those pitchers up there. They're all kind of older guys, so it kind of helped me transition just dealing with some older guys, obviously being a younger guy at catching. But I think the greatest thing last year was being able to go on the road and be a part of that travel roster, I guess you can say. And I think I was on just about every trip. So every road trip, I was sitting in on the meetings between Tucker and Kurt and all the pitchers with DJ. And just kind of experiencing the lifestyle of it, being on the road and stuff, and just being able to catch those guys because I was pretty much a bullpen catcher. So I think that was obviously the most beneficial part of just kind of helping me ease my way into it.
See, there you go. There's Tyler Stevenson. Now you got one of the catchers. You need the other catcher. Here's the Gold Glove winner, 2020 National League Gold Glove winner at catcher for the second time, Tucker Barnhart. He is now going to bat left-handed exclusively, right? So here is Tucker talking about that.
Yeah, I'd always been a switch hitter. Growing up, I did it. But obviously, when you're young, you're not facing a lot of left-handed pitchers. At least you weren't back when I was young. And it just seemed like one of those things where I always went into an off season, specifically right-handed, and tried to kind of redo everything, kind of go back to the drawing board every single off season. And that got, to be honest, mentally exhausting, as well as physically, trying to maintain two swings. When you're going good left-handed, you seem to always be up there right-handed. When you were going good right-handed, which wasn't very often for me, you had to hit left-handed. So it was one of those things where I'm naturally left-handed, a left-handed hitter. And for me, I didn't want to look back at the end of my career. I know it didn't, the numbers weren't very good last year, but last year, in my opinion, was you can throw that away, good or bad. But for me, it was one of those things where when my career is over with, I don't want to say what if. And for me, I'm confident in me as a left-handed hitter specifically, and I've done a lot of work to get better, and again, to familiarize myself with that side of the plate exclusively. And I'm excited to get going.
Now, Tucker Barnhart, you want to hear Tucker Barnhart talking about catching Hunter Green? Because everybody's intrigued by Hunter. You want that? I'll give you some. Here's Tucker talking about catching Hunter Green.
No, that was the first time I caught him, and I kind of made it a priority to make sure that I did catch him. You know, I've watched a lot of his videos. I've seen him on social media and things like that. It's always different when you get to catch a guy for the first time and you're comparing it to that stuff. But it was impressive. I mean, his fastball is electric. His willingness to learn and his want to learn was very evident yesterday. We had a conversation in between during the bullpen, and then he sent me a text last night about 6 or 7 o'clock at night, just thanking me and stuff like that. So it's his willingness to learn and want to get better is awesome to see, and obviously the talent's there, and it's just going to be continue to mature and get some innings on his arm, and hopefully he's up here sooner rather than later.
All right, there you go, Tucker Barnhart talking about catching Hunter Green in a bullpen session. So there you are, 19 away from 5 o'clock. I told you it's catcher's day, okay? I think I'd be willing to bet that the catching situation by the end of the year, we feel better about it with Tyler Stevenson than maybe we did at the end of last year. Let's get to what I think is the biggest question in college basketball. We'll do that next on ESPN 1530, Cincinnati Sports Station. You should do that, and you should download the iHeartRadio app and listen to us anytime, anywhere, and literally anytime. This is not one that I thought I was going to hear today. This was requested. Very good. You're doing a request today, aren't you? I forgot. You tweeted that out. Doing a request. 4:45, this is ESPN 1530. I'm Mo Egger. We'll do some college hoops. Coming up at 5:20, Papa John's weekend tip-off, we look at all the games. We talked about Xavier, what they have in front of it, UC and Houston on Sunday, a monumental task for the Bearcats. And the Zach Harvey thing, he leaves, the sort of revolving door of players coming in and out has overshadowed the fact that the Bearcats have played better over their last four games. I thought the first 15 minutes against UCF was as well as I've seen Cincinnati run half-court offense in a long time, probably all year long. And I think they've made some improvements defensively, and they look a little bit more cohesive. And you can say what you want. The games have been close. They're not playing great competition. But just the dreaded eye test, they have looked better these last four games than they did the previous 10, for the most part. Now, what that's going to mean for Sunday, I don't know. I thought Houston defensively was a wreck last night against a Wichita State team that needed that win. Wichita State is, I think, played themselves onto the bubble. And sometimes when you say that, it's not good. I think in Wichita State's case, you say it, and it is a good thing. The American Athletic Conference is guaranteed to get Houston. They've got a shot to get maybe a 2 seed. And we'll see about Wichita State. SMU's got an outside shot. Nobody else in this league looks like an NCAA tournament team. Nobody on this team has an NCAA tournament resume. I really would wonder this. And granted, the AAC is not the only league that's going to have to deal with this. If you're the American Athletic Conference, the conference tournament, which, by the way, they're going to allow, I think I saw 3,000 fans in Fort Worth, which the tournament starts March the 11th. If you're the AAC, do you want Houston playing in your tournament? If the automatic bid, if you're going to give your league's automatic bid to your tournament champion, and Houston doesn't play in it, somebody else is going to make the NCAA tournament. Now, Wichita State might have a profile by then that has them in. They're 13-4. That was a great win last night. And again, just from a basketball standpoint, the way they were able to break Houston down off the bounce was impressive. It's a good win. But Houston's making the NCAA tournament. There's nothing getting around that. We asked this from a team standpoint a couple of weeks ago, right? Like, if you're in the tournament, Ohio State get a one seed. Chris Holtmann, I think, should be the national coach of the year. Ohio State was picked to finish seventh in Big Ten to start the season. And now we're talking about them as a one seed. Huge showdown against Michigan on Sunday. But as much as getting a one seed is cool, they're a little bit different because the tournament, they're going to shack up in Indy and stay there for the NCAAs. Still, if teams can opt out of their conference tournaments, why would you want to play in it? And if you're the American Athletic Conference, you know, you're not going to come out and tell Houston to not play, but you could say the same thing about the West Coast Conference and Gonzaga and BYU. It's really good for these leagues if they get as many teams as they possibly can. AAC has one team that right now you would say definitively is in. Teams can opt out. Why wouldn't you tell Houston, hey, opt out? And on top of that, you know, I would ask this about Xavier if the Big East tournament comes around and they are clearly in. And leagues can determine to give their automatic bids to regular season champions. Leagues can also move their conference tournaments. The Atlantic 10 has flip-flopped the men's and women's tournament. Now the final, by the way, is going to be played at UD Arena. But from a team standpoint, if you're in, you have a good enough resume, you are in the NCAA tournament. And yet, when you go to Indy, you have to have 7 straight days of negative COVID tests. Are you better off getting on a plane and playing a bunch of games in consecutive days, staying in a hotel, or putting yourself in a bubble, basically, practicing, having your guys just be with each other, kind of what teams have been doing all year long, and ensuring that everybody's available for the NCAAs? There is no guarantee, but ensuring that everybody's available for the NCAA tournament. If I'm a coach, if I'm an AD, and my team's going to be in the NCAA tournament, that conference tournament is useless. It is completely useless if we're giving teams the option to opt out. But on top of that, if it serves the league to have as many teams qualify for the NCAA tournament as it possibly can, again, the AAC is a prime example. Houston's in, man, so why would you want Houston to play in the... Hey, our automatic bid is going to go to a team who's... Whoever wins the conference tournament, let's take our one bona fide, legit, in, definitively in team, take them out, have everybody else play for that automatic bid. Now we have 2 teams. Depending on what happens with Wichita State or SMU, you have 3 teams. I think it's kind of college basketball's biggest question right now. They're leaving it up to individual leagues, much like they left it up to individual leagues last year when all those conference tournaments got canceled. Remember, it wasn't the NCAA that stepped up and said, hey, the Big East tournament's canceled, the AAC tournament's canceled, the Big Ten tournament's canceled. The leagues did that individually. Leagues can do whatever they choose to do individually with their own conference tournaments. But given the requirement to play in Indy in the NCAAs, why would you compromise that by having teams play against each other in their conference tournaments? And if you can manipulate things and squeeze one more team as an automatic bid in, it's one thing if you have like 5 teams who are guaranteed to be in, you look at their resume, you can't hold all them out. But again, a league like the AAC, how much you want Houston to wait? We hold them out. We can get another team in the tournament plus Houston. Awesome. And I can't imagine the selection committee is going to, like, you know, really dock teams for opting out when it comes to their seed. And again, the benefits of getting as high a seed of as possible from an opt-out standpoint, as high of a seed as possible, does that outweigh the possible risk you run of having somebody have their availability for the NCAA tournament get compromised because they played in a conference tournament? It's the biggest thing hovering over this sport right now. 513-749-1530. And 866-702-3776. The UC thing, we've talked about Zach Harvey leaving and roster instability and all that stuff. And I'm interested in what we see from the Bearcats. Look, losing Zach Harvey it's not good. It's not good maybe for your future. Mechanically speaking, he was one of those guys that on a game in a game out basis, could you really expect anything? You know, early in the game against Temple last Friday, he gave them 8 points, and he's had some flashes this year, really right before their long layoff, where it kind of felt like maybe the light bulb was coming on. But I don't know that you were going – I don't know that their chances of winning at Houston, which aren't great to begin with, I don't know if they're decreased all that much because they don't have Zach. Clearly, there's not as much depth. And you do get to a point where you're playing walk-ons, and that was the case against Temple, and it was the case against Tulane. But the guys who are going to help you pull off an upset, that list probably doesn't include Zach Harvey. So I like how they've played, and look, they haven't put 40 minutes together. They can't sustain success. It was frustrating as hell. They built a 10-point lead in the first half against UCF, were really, really playing well. They went in up one. They haven't been able to sustain much, but that's from where they were to what they are now, it's drastically different, and perhaps more strides made on Sunday. I fear because of the quality of the opposition, those strides aren't going to be enough for them to actually go ahead and win the game. 6 minutes away from 5 o'clock. When I look at a team and try to figure out how good or bad they're going to be, I always look at the margin for error, right? The margin for error, which is things like depth and just, overall quality of your team, lack of weaknesses, glaring holes. The Reds, I think most of us would agree, in 2021 are going to operate with a pretty thin margin for error, which to me is going to put a premium on two things. We'll talk about them both next on ESPN 1530 Cincinnati Sports Station.
No one covers the Bengals like ESPN 1530, Cincinnati's sports station.
Hi, I'm Mo Egger. This is ESPN 1530. Thank you for listening. I hope your weekend is off to an awesome start. Oh, look. NKU hoops coming up at the bottom of the hour. The Norse hosting Wright State. Tip off at 6. Jim Kelch and Rick Boring take over at 5:30. We'll look at the entire weekend of college basketball coming up. In just about 15 minutes, I am looking forward to that. Looking forward to that. Quickly, a couple of things on the Reds. There is a really good chance you haven't spent much time this offseason thinking about the impact that the Reds were going to get this season from a guy they acquired last November from the Houston Astros by the name of Brandon Bailey, but he had been in the mix for a possible bullpen role, made his major league debut last year, did a nice job. Reds got him for cash considerations. Unfortunately for Brandon, he is going to have Tommy John surgery for the second time in his life, and so he is not going to pitch in 2021. He had Tommy John surgery in high school and has gone on to play professionally and get to the big league. So it was an obstacle, but not one that he couldn't overcome, and hopefully he can overcome it again and pitch in 2022. That kind of the big Reds news of the day. I was talking on Cincy 360 today with Tony Pike, and this has been a little bit of a theme of mine, I'll admit, but I was asking him about kind of the overall vibe, tone, consensus of the Reds now versus a year ago. A year ago, it was enthusiasm, optimism, a lot of hope, and I don't detect as much of that now. And I, on a basic kind of surface level, I get it. Last year's team proved to be okay. And this offseason, they've not done anything to make the team better. And in some respects, They've almost intentionally made the team worse. And the one kind of objective of the offseason in terms of adding to the roster was not met. They didn't get a shortstop. It's still a glaring hole. And yet, for me, and perhaps this is because I didn't buy that this was like the runaway favorite in the Central. I didn't buy that this was going to be a 90-win team. And even when we saw it was going to be a 60-game season, I didn't buy that they were going to run away with the division. I thought they had a chance to compete. I thought they had a chance to get to the postseason. I thought they had a shot to win the division. But I kind of felt like it was them just sort of meshed in, and you could throw the Brewers, Cubs, Cardinals, and Reds in a hat, pick one, and there's your favorite. Like, I didn't think they were clear-cut favorites. I thought they had a shot to be pretty good. I thought they'd finish with a winning record. I thought they were going to contend. I thought it would have been a hell of a fun summer. I didn't think they were going to be great. I also don't think they're going to be awful. And maybe the bar should be higher here. We should have higher standards than, well, they're not going to be terrible, but in this division, not being terrible probably puts you in contention, at least on some level. So we're having this conversation with Tony today. And he brought up something. He brought up the defense. He's like, man, that infield, look at that defensively. How many ground balls are going to get through? How many double plays are really going to be turned? And this is a very, very fair concern. This is not, in all likelihood, going to be top to bottom. Doesn't project to be a very good defensive team. And this is kind of the part of the sport that we spend the least amount of time talking about, but it is critical. I always look at teams in terms of margin for error. How wide or how small is the margin for error? How much can you afford an injury or weakness, or how many mistakes can you make? How strong are your strengths and how devastating are your weaknesses? How many strengths do you have? How many weaknesses do you have? This team, if you look at it top to bottom, there's a lot of stuff that's kind of middle of the pack, right? Like their lineup top to bottom and all throughout baseball, it's probably not collectively going to produce as poorly as it did last year, but it's probably not going to be great either. There's some depth. There's not a ton of quality. Kind of middle of the pack, right? I think their starting staff, the top of it's pretty good. It's not as good as it was last year with Trevor Bauer. I think there's some decent options to fill out the back end of the rotation that a lot of teams would like to have. It's probably kind of middle of the pack, maybe top end of the middle of the pack, but middle of the pack starting rotation. Bullpen, I kind of feel the same way. So the margin for error, right? How do you take your team as a whole and slide it closer to the top of the pack? Or how does it maybe take your team and slide it closer to the bottom of the pack? You shrink the margin for error. Defense is enormous. This team will probably play in a lot of close games. They're going to be in a division race that's probably going to be really close. In a 60-game season, the four teams that weren't the Pirates were separated by 5 games, right? Now, that's kind of to be expected because of the length of the season, but still, these teams were clustered really closely together. And I think that's kind of the expectation this year. 4 teams clustered kind of closely together. The Reds are probably going to play in a lot of close games. Chances are they're not going to be an offensive force. Chances are there's going to be a starting staff that's not as good as last year's. How do you widen or shrink the margin for error? With your gloves, with your defense. And it's not just errors. I'm interested, by the end of the year, how many outs does this team give away? How many hits are turned into outs? How many outs are turned into hits? How many bases are given away? How many errors do they make? Some of the stuff is not necessarily quantified in the box score, but that's a really big part of this team for me this year, right? You widen or shrink your margin of error. Your defense isn't as good. Offense has to overcome. Is this offense good enough to overcome? Can you overcome whatever hitting shortcomings you have by making every play in the field? Unfortunately, when you look at some of the personnel, it does create cause for concern. Joey Votto is not a good defensive first baseman. Mike Moustakas is not going to remind anybody of Brandon Phillips. There's a possibility that they use a catcher at shortstop. A Eugenio Suarez is fine. Jesse Winker is not. Nick Castellanos is not. Shogo Akiyama is. Don't know how much he plays. Nick Senzel. Eh. The Reds counter this by 2 things, and I agree with these 2 things. Number one, they'll say, look, our staff, I talked about this with Dick Williams in spring training last year. Their staff doesn't give up a ton of contact. And that is statistically true. It's easier to say that when you have Trevor Bauer, but you still have three starting pitchers. And if Lorenzen makes the staff, you have four starting pitchers who average more than a strikeout per inning last year. You have three guys who average more than 11 strikeouts per nine. Also, baseball, the way it's played in this day and age, there's less balls put in play, right? Three true outcome hitters, walks, strikeouts, home runs. The good and bad of that is your defense can't screw it up because the ball's not in play anymore. Home runs, defense doesn't have to do anything, and strikeouts and walks kind of the same thing. But still, it's not like every out recorded is via strikeout. How does this team do defensively? And it's going to have some guys who aren't regarded as good defenders to perhaps play in the field above their capabilities. And they're also going to tell you, and I believe this too, by the way, they've put a lot into fielder placement. It's analytical, having guys in the right spots, positioning players in the right spots. They're going to tell you we're much, much better at that. We're as good at that as we've ever been, and that's going to help us overcome maybe some of the shortcomings when it comes to guys getting to balls that aren't hit right at them. But still, to me, in a year like this, in large part because of just the margin for error and how close everything is, this is really worth paying attention to. The other part is managing. I'll admit to you, I'm the guy that probably talks about managing the least because I just don't think it matters that much in the grand scheme of things. But baseball people always say, like, yeah, your manager impacts the result like 5 to 10 times per year. I'm not even sure the number is that many. But in a division race where it feels like there's a good chance at least that four teams are sort of within a handful of games of each other, who knows how one or two managerial moves could swing this entire thing. And for a manager who this year maybe doesn't have quite the starting staff to give him quite as many innings as last year and doesn't have quite as many horses in the bullpen as he had last year, I don't know why I called them horses, but it does put a little bit more stress on managerial decision-making. And in a year like this, the margin for error is small, and everything's going to be cloistered very, very tightly, possibly, probably even best case. There's a premium on sound managerial decision-making. 13 minutes after 5 o'clock, this is ESPN 1530. I'm Mo Egger, 513-749-1530, and 866-702-3776. All right, you're going to hear from John Brandon. Bearcats are playing Houston this weekend. You are going to hear from Travis Steele. Xavier's going to play Butler this weekend. You are going to hear from John Calipari. Papa John's weekend tip-off. Look at all the action this weekend next on ESPN 1530 Cincinnati Sports Station. It's 18 minutes away from 5 o'clock. This is ESPN 1530. I'm Mo Egger. And KU basketball is coming up at the bottom of the hour. Jim Kelch and Rick Boring will take over as NKU hosts Wright State. We'll talk about here in just a second. First, Papa John's weekend tip-off time. Papa John's weekend tip-off is a service of your locally owned and operated Papa John's Pizza. Here's what you do. Do this tonight. You got college basketball in the area tonight. You've got college basketball in the area tomorrow. You've got college basketball pretty much all day on Sunday. So this is great for the weekend. If you go to PapaJohns.com and enter promo code SIN. $13.99. That's CIN1399. You can get a large specialty or five topping pizza for just $13.99. How about that? A large specialty pizza or a five topping pizza for just $13.99. You cannot beat that. Order PapaJohns.com. CIN1399. Order right now. Going to be good to go by the time maybe not the NKU tip off, but the Dayton Flyers tip off at 7 o'clock. We go in chronological order. Can I say that again? We go in chronological order. NKU is hosting Wright State tonight. Raiders have a good record. Their net ranking is 58. They've lost their last two games by 2 points. A very good record. I think, and look, I'm not going to lie to you, I'm not that well-versed on great Horizon League rivalries, especially in this era of the Horizon League. But because these two programs have been very good, their proximity to one another, NKU and Wright State, I think, have developed a really good rivalry. Norris come into tonight having won 7 of 8, their only loss. The OT loss to Green Bay on Friday night. This is a good Wright State team, man. They're averaging 82 a game. They're really good at limiting opponents from three. Opposing teams are shooting just 29% from behind the arc. And so, and two teams who have been pretty good this season at rebounding the basketball. It's tip off at 6 p.m. tonight on ESPN 1530 pregame show. Starts in 10 minutes. Dayton is playing St. Louis at UD Arena. Flyers won the first game. It was St. Louis's first in over a month back on January the 27th. 76-71 the final score. Billikens haven't won at UD Arena since January of 2014. They've won four straight games. The Flyers on Tuesday night played really well for stretches of time against Rhode Island, built an 18-point lead, and you could just feel it coming. They lose the game in overtime, a devastating defeat. The pieces this year, this is going to be the easiest, simplest, grossest oversimplification ever. They miss Obi Toppin. They're playing slower. They're nowhere near as efficient. There's a lot of the same dudes back. They're very senior heavy. The pieces don't fit. Jalen Crutcher's having a very good year. I think it might be the worst very good year that I've ever seen. 7 p.m. tonight. The Flyers hosting the Billikens. New tomorrow, Indiana hosting Michigan State. It kind of felt like the Hoosiers were going to unravel. They lose at home a couple of weeks ago to Illinois in overtime. They've since won 3 out of 4. Beat Minnesota this week after getting smoked by Ohio State. Still, the Hoosiers' margin for error is really, really small. They've got a game against Michigan still in front of them. First things first, Michigan State. We talk about all these blue bloods who have fallen apart this year. Sparty is one of them. They've lost their last two. Iowa last week absolutely creamed them by 30 points. Most brackets, if you go to bracketmatrix.com, have the Hoosiers right there squarely on the bubble as like a 10 or, in most cases, an 11 seed. They can ill afford a loss tomorrow against the Spartans. That game tips off at noon. Kentucky against teams that aren't that good has figured some stuff out offensively. They've scored 80-plus in each of their last three, 82 in their last two, both wins over Auburn and Vanderbilt. They're playing a Tennessee team. 2 weeks ago, played Tennessee, first half, up by 8. Things were clicking offensively, and then if it could go wrong, it did in the second half. They were outscored 48-29. That game was at Rupp Arena. This game is going to be in Knoxville. John Calipari on how he views road games like a version of the NBA bubble in an effort to bring his team together.
Told them about the NBA bubble. Miami was in fifth place, and when I talked to anyone in the bubble, they said there were two teams that bonded unbelievably well, and that was Miami and that was LA, and look who was in the finals. So I said, use this time to be together. But the team's coming together. The reason they are coming together is because they're playing for each other.
1 p.m. tomorrow on ESPN. 15:30. Miami's at Northern Illinois, who is dreadful. 1-8 in the MAC. They're 2-12. They have fired their coach. Red Hawks have lost 4 straight and 5 out of 6. They've added games to the schedule. Miami's going to play 4 times between tomorrow and next Saturday. First of those 4 will be at 6 p.m. tomorrow. On Sunday, the UC Bearcats play for the first time in a week. Cincinnati, now without Zach Harvey, will be at Houston. Cougars last night lose to Wichita State. I don't think the Cougars defended all that well. This is an immensely tough task for the Bearcats. John Brandon's now not going to have Zach Harvey. It's a week off. They have won 4 straight games. Here's John Brandon on getting his team focused to face a very good opponent in line possibly for a 2 seed after a 1 week layoff.
Yeah, I tell you guys all the time, what are you walking into? Okay, so you're walking into a team that's known for their physicality. Each and every year they're at the top of the country in rebounding. They've got a veteran team with the gold standard in terms of the culture right now that they've been able to get over the last 7 years or 8 years with Kelvin. And they just come off a loss. So you got to know what you're walking into. And, you know, our young men understand that, and we're excited about getting down there. Certainly our thoughts and prayers go to the people, you know, with Houston. I know it's been hit really hard in terms of the weather and the loss of water and power. So I know that there's a part of that our guys are asking about. We certainly have thought about that going down. But this is what you want. You want to go down there and play. I think is the best team in the league, certainly a top 10 team in the country, and they have been all season.
Top 10 team in the country in line right now, possibly for a two seed. Clearly the only AAC team that's destined to make the NCAA tournament, but right now, and league standings are weird because of the inequities in games played, but right now, Houston, after losing to Wichita State last night, no longer leading the conference. Half game behind the Shockers, who won that game in Wichita last night. And again, the Shockers have played themselves into at least a situation where you could consider them a bubble team. And well, frankly, that was not the case for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. Game of the weekend in Columbus on Sunday at 1 o'clock. Talk about teams in line for a one seed. I think Chris Holtmann should be the National Coach of the Year. The Buckeyes were picked to finish 7th in the Big Ten. And now most projections have them as a number one seed. They play a Michigan team that is really good and really fun to watch. Long layoff. They took care of Rutgers last night. I lost a Skyline bet to Tony Pike. 1 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. Ohio State and Michigan is a better basketball rivalry right now than it is a football rivalry. Sorry, I said it. Don't get mad at me. It's true. Has a lot to do with how good those two teams are, at least this season. On Sunday, Xavier is going to try to break a two-game losing streak. The Musketeers hosting Butler at the Cintas Center. We all saw what happened on Sunday night. St. John's hung 93 on them, 7 dunks. It was brutal. Travis Steele talked about going back to square one when it comes to teaching his team how to play defense.
But we're excited to get back out here, and I want to see our defense progress. Can't get any worse than it was against St. John's. And we don't have weeks to figure it out. We have days to figure it out. And, you know, I feel like we kind of went back to day one of practice. That's kind of how we've retaught it, going back to the first, like I said, first day of practice. And I thought it was good. I thought guys had the right attitude. I thought guys went really, really hard. We went the day after. We got in about 5 a.m. on whatever morning that was. I think the game was this game on Tuesday. Yeah, the game was Tuesday night, so we got in about 5 a.m. on Wednesday morning. And we practiced that day.
I bet you that was fun. Musketeers won the first game a couple of weeks ago at Hinkle Fieldhouse. Paul Scruggs, great down the stretch, 68-55. Xavier's an NCAA tournament team right now. I don't think we want to get this to the point where we talk about how they've moved closer to the bubble in a week when they play Creighton a week from tomorrow. First things first, Butler, Sunday at 7. They also have the Providence game on Wednesday, 7 o'clock, pregame at 6:30 on 700 WLW. Papa John's Weekend Tip-Off is a service of your locally owned and operated Papa John's stores. Go to papajohns.com, enter promo code CIN1399, and you can get a 5-topping pizza or any large specialty pizza, for just $13.99. Do it tonight. Do it tomorrow. Do it Sunday. Thank me later. PapaJohns.com. Thanks to your locally owned and operated Papa John's stores. We're done? We're done? We're finished? We're out of here? We're gone? Finny? Let's see. You could go to the podcast page of ESPN1530.com. You could hear old shows. You could hear this show. I mean, not now, in just a few minutes. I'm not sure why you'd want to. You could hear interviews, anything you might have missed on the podcast page of ESPN1530.com. Don't forget, Cincy 360 is now our 2-hour show, noon to 2 with Tony Pike on Monday. And we are right back at it here Monday at 3:05. Looking forward to that. I would ask Taryn what we have on the show, but he doesn't know, and neither do I. Monday, 3:05. Have a great weekend. Thanks to Taryn for producing. Thanks to you for listening. NKU basketball is coming up next with Jim Kelch and Rick Boring. This is ESPN 1530, Cincinnati's sports station.